Talk given Friday, 9th February, 1979. The brain synthesizes our sense impressions mainly through our speech faculty. We are taught by those around us from our birth onwards how to use our speech faculty. The impressions we receive are named for us. And so, in time, the process of cognition and recognition, recognition, grows. And the speech faculty plays probably the most important part in all this process. But because we are taught by those around us, what happens is that we are molded in their likeness. If we are born and bred in England, our mode of feeling, thinking, speaking, understanding, everything is conditioned accordingly, according to our upbringing and our education. If we were born in Patagonia, it would be different. Or if we were the children of the Australian Aborigines, again, it would be quite different. You see? So, what the net result is that our ordinary, everyday, worldly consciousness is confined to sense and brain functioning. And this is our unavoidable starting point. But dormant in us, in each and every single person on the globe, all of whom are psychophysical organisms, as ordinary living persons belonging to the human species. Dormant in us are sensitivities, potentialities, and energy stirrings which strive to break through our confinement. I'm talking of the confinement of our consciousness. We are aware of existence in the manner in which we are aware, through all this conditioning. Insofar as these energy stirrings, potentialities, and so forth are in line with the life trends towards fulfillment for the human species, it is well with us, with each one of us, to let this come about by one, perception of, and two, cooperation with these trends. If we are fortunate enough really to see, to perceive these trends, and then wise enough to cooperate with them, then it is well with us, each one of us, in the true sense of the word, the true sense of being well. Otherwise, it is ill with us. And the whole world's history, and especially what is happening nowadays in our own times, is ample, irrefutable evidence of this. But to perceive thus and then to cooperate is not easy. It is here that our difficulties begin. The main life trend in man, the main trend, is for consciousness to realize, release out of confinement within finitude, separateness, and hence lack of wholeness, within time, and hence mortality, within fortuitous change, and hence confusion, useless conflict, sorrow, and disorder. To realize release out of all that into the consciousness of wholeness, holiness, which means of non-finitude, of immortality, of eternity. Consciousness is the subtlest unknown thing inside us. It is not to be identified with states of mind, with the modes of sense perception, with the modes, I said moans nearly, but perhaps subconsciously that also applies, with the modes of what we commonly call our thinking process, whether it be concerned with with concrete things of everyday life, or whether it be concerned with attempting to penetrate into the truth of life, into what is the reality, and so forth. All this, which I've just mentioned, is an expression of that which is fundamental, our mode of awareness of our own and the environment, environmental existence. If we are conscious in a different way, then all one's thinking, feeling, interpreting, everything undergoes change accordingly. It expresses that mysterious, unknown thing, consciousness. And this is the great life trend in the human kingdom, this transformation of consciousness. We can't deliberately bring it about. It takes place through a very subtle, a very mysterious process of natural growth. All we can do is to be so observant of everything that we cease to obstruct this flowering out of consciousness. And do remember that whilst your particular thinking, speaking, etc., is your own thinking, speaking mainly, influenced, of course, by environment, other people, and so on and so on, your consciousness, a convenient phrase to use, is not your property, exclusive to you. Consciousness in you is simultaneously universal. That is why when one person as we commonly, to use a common phrase, any one person undergoes this utter transformation of consciousness and become the nexus of transcendence itself, all mankind is affected. Now, become the nexus of transcendence. And the context of transcendence is infinity, non-finitude, non-particularity, no qualities, characteristics in our sense of the term. It is immortality, no beginning and ending in this transformation process. Neither time nor timelessness in our sense of those words, but eternity. And the transcendent completely subsumes all these partial expressions of it which take place through us as we are. These are not easy things to think of, to form mental pictures. Try and get the feel of it and let the brain stop chattering. Now, such is the life trend in and for man. I've tried to suggest by the sounds I have made, the words in the English language which I have spoken, I've tried to suggest what this life trend is for man. Now, how can we perceive this? It's a deep question. In order to perceive truly, one must possess the organs of perception. Supposing, as we are looking, we say, I see a bookcase. Rays of light have come from that bookcase. I have eyes. I have a brain on which certain impressions are made, and then I perform that psychical act, and it's a bit of a mystery how that psychical act is performed, and I say, I see a bookcase. The scientific analysis of the functioning of the senses just goes thus far as its mechanism is concerned. But its psychological counterpart, which enables a living person to say, I see a bookcase, is still unknown, unanalyzed by science. It may someday do it, but at present it still remains a mystery. So now you see, this is what we mean by perception. Then again, we interpret things according to our conditioning. The same sort of event which is interpreted by us in Britain in this way is likely to be interpreted somewhat differently, sometimes perhaps quite differently, by people who live in some other distant part of the world which has had no contact with us, let us say. They would interpret it quite differently. They would say that they perceived this, that and the other. we say we perceived this, that and the other with respect to the same event. So you see, perception in our meaning of the word has no relationship to perception in the transcendent meaning of the word, in the context of infinity, immortality and eternity. But that has every relationship with what we call perception, because it completely subsumes us. It is a little bit like this. Our mode of functioning is as if we had a piano where only the first two octaves were available to us. As and when this spiritual liberation takes place and the transformation of consciousness goes on, in what we call the deep states of consciousness, of unity and so on, perhaps two more octaves are available to us. But for the fully realized human, it is as if the entire range on the piano was available to that person. The enlightened consciousness has the full range at his command. So his perceptions, similarly, are something quite different from what we mean by perception. This is one I'm trying to suggest the very great difficulty. And if we really are serious about living the religious life and look inwards into ourselves, we will see that almost 99% of what we think and believe and do and so forth, we are in the wrong. Life, in the real sense, is a voyage of discovery. It is not a voyage of discovery of the truth for us human beings. It is a voyage of discovery of our ignorance, our ill state, our obstructiveness to transcendence. When that discovery is complete, you and transcendence are not two. They are absolutely one. Not merely a not two in the Advaita Vedanta sense, but an absolute oneness. Now you see, words like this immediately conjure up thoughts and pictures in our psyche. And we believe, yes, I see, I don't see. Remain in that state of divine negation with respect to the whole of the self, what we call the self, and the functionings, the modes of functioning of the self. Then, perhaps, you will be a man, a woman. Isn't it Kipling's, if for something, and then you will be, it ends up, you will be a man, my son. You will be a man, my son. Obviously, this is not easy. It is difficult. Now, almost everyone, therefore, is held fast by his conditioning in the prison of his own ignorance. Each man does not even know, he has no inkling even, that he is ignorant. Look at the factors in the way of believing, leave alone believing, of even beginning to see that I am ignorant. Self-esteem, vanity, egoism, conceit, and worst of all, I have succeeded in this, that and the other. I am somebody. God forgive me. See, that is how we function. Our consciousness has not escaped this prison house. Each man is ignorant of the fundamental fact that his mode of awareness of existence is in terms of the worldly, enslaved, subhuman, often truly brutish, as we know from not just history, but what happens around us even. And his mode of awareness is not in terms of the creative, free, fully blossomed human. And I use the word creative, don't think in terms of what we commonly call a creative person, a creative genius and all that sort of thing. Person who can express to the full, as far as dualistic consciousness will allow him to express himself. Occasionally he breaks through that limitation, and then it is the divine itself which writes that symphony or poem or builds that building or makes that statue. But that's extremely, extremely rare. Only very rarely any of the great creative geniuses, as we call them, have been truly creative in that divine sense. We are all procreative. Biologically and culturally, we have talked about this before several times, so I won't go into it again. We are procreative because we produce true to type. But this freedom of creative power is of such a nature that it knows no restriction whatsoever. No, just try and feel this, not emotionally, not sentimentally, otherwise it will only intensify egoism and vanity in ourselves. I am one of the chosen few, and you won't know that you are being, you're fooling yourself. But just be quiet. Be nothing. All the profound religious teachings of the world have emphasized this point. In Christian mysticism, it is expressed in these terms: when you are reduced to your own nothingness, then the Lord is in you. Free. I said creative free. This freedom is something we don't know, and don't try to picture it. our psyches, our brains are completely defeated, where the realization, the experiencing, the actual living of this freedom is concerned. Fully blossomed humans, and the word human means the happy creator. Creator in the sense in which theistic religions have spoken of God as the creator. And God as creator is divinely blissful. Nothing to do with our definitions of bliss, pleasure, happiness, fulfillment, success, ecstasy, all that is rubbish and nonsense. Besides this, blossoming. You might say, you are incredibly anthropocentric. I'm not. I'm not anthropocentric at all. I'm not exalting anthropos, man, as recognized and understood the world over. But if you see the meaning of the word man, you will see that it means God. Who wrote the scriptures? Who produced the least troublesome or misleading forms of those teachings which enable man to get free of being an obstruction to transcendence? You and I, men, women, they produced this. Several of the hymns of the Rig Veda have been produced by women. Did you know that? Several of the greatest of the sages of the Upanishadic teachings have been women. So, you and I, men and women, it is they who have written about these things, spoken about them, and so forth. No sort of mythical non-human being did it. A human being did it. Simply because he had become that nexus for transcendence, for the free inflow and outflow of transcendence. Now, merely hearing or reading such words does not liberate us. Why? Because our conditioning compels us to interpret it all in the subhuman way. We are not fully human, fully blossomed humans. We are under that stage, less than that stage, subhuman. I don't mean subhuman pejoratively at all. But we are, that's the fact, we are subhuman. Only the perfected holy ones are the true humans. And because our conditioning compels us to interpret it all in the subhuman way, we cannot understand the truth. We cannot see in the sense of be totally conscious of, be at home with it, be that which we are seeing in mind and consciousness. Can't be it physically, But in mind and consciousness, this is what happens. We cannot see the whole fact immediately with unerring insight. All our perceptions are indeed, as Mahayana Buddhism puts it, non-perceptions, no perceptions. We could just as well say that our perceptions are misperceptions very largely. And certainly they are distorted perceptions. In the complete meaning of the term. Now, I mentioned the Mahayana. And last time I quoted one or two things, and it will be well worth our while to look into them again, some of them. First of all, the Buddha is talking to Subhuti. He was one of the perfected holy ones who lived in peace. And the Buddha is telling Subhuti, that's anyone who has decided to tread the path of the Bodhisattva should produce a thought in this manner. Bodhisattva literally means Bodhi is wisdom, Sattva is being, a wisdom being. As many beings as there are in the universe of beings, the Bodhisattva produces this thought. Now, note the words, produces this thought, troublesome words. All these beings I must lead to nirvana, into the realm of nirvana which leaves nothing behind. And yet, although innumerable beings have thus been led to nirvana, no being at all has been led to nirvana. And why? If in a bodhisattva the notion of a being should take place, he could not be called a wisdom being, a bodhisattva. And why? He is not to be called a wisdom being in whom the notion of a self or of a being should take place, or the notion of a living soul or of a person. Remember, the Buddha is talking to one of the perfected ones. It is doubtful whether he actually... I would not be surprised if actually such conversations did not take place. The modes of communication between perfected holy ones at this level, at this depth and wholeness and completeness, do not need thoughts and words. But for the sake of those who come after, somebody puts them in thoughts and words. Now, Dr. Kanza has done something very valuable here. He shows us what is meant by some of these terms. The Bodhisattva should have no perception of a self. Self, that is, no belief in the existence of an ego as distinct from the five skandhas, the elements which compose the psychophysical man. Form, feeling, what we call perceptions, volitions, and what we call consciousness, which is restricted, discriminative consciousness. So, the belief of the existence of an ego as distinct from these five aspects which compose the psychophysical being, an ego the belief in an ego being defined as that of which we could say, this is mine, I am this, this is myself. That cannot be said by any one of us. In reality, second, no perception of a, that's how he defines self, no perception of a being, that is, no belief in a continuous, separate individual, note, separate individual, identical with himself at different times, who could validly differentiate his internal constituents from what is outside him. Take our ordinary experience of eating food. We say, oh, that substance is outside me at the moment. When I've eaten it, what's happened? Has that food become me? And when the process of digestion takes place and there is assimilation and elimination going on, wheresoever there is elimination, does that mean that I have this become? This, that, or the other? So, no perception of a being, no perception of a soul, that is, no belief in the existence of a unifying and vivifying force within an individual organism, which, for the span of a lifetime, would persist from conception to death. Now, we are all well aware of the fact that we are conscious of ourselves as I am I from the time we are, well, soon after we are born, till we actually die, or a little bit before we die, if we go into a coma or unconsciousness and so on. We know that we say, I am I, I am I. But what we forget is that this arbitrary statement in words has no substantial reality behind it. There is no identifiable, unchanging entity. And because we are unaware of that, we act self-centeredly, self-orientedly all the time, and introduce conflict, separation, and so on in our world. We obstruct the life trend. no perception of a person, that is, no belief in the existence of a permanent entity who would migrate from rebirth to rebirth, from one birth to another birth. No identifiable entity at all. That is why for the last 2 decades nearly, I have persistently said that the popular picture of rebirth, reincarnation, transmigration is a hopelessly false and misleading picture. Hopelessly false. Now, Dr. Kanza goes on. Explaining another statement of the Buddha. Nor do these bodhisattvas have a perception of a dharma or a perception of a no dharma. No perception or non-perception takes place in them. It's frightfully hard to concentrate attention upon all these, but do try. You see? Now, before I go on to that, we must just see what is meant by the word dharma in this context. Dharma has so many meanings. It's derived from dhri, meaning to uphold. I won't read the ontological sense. We did that last in January. Now, come to this definition of dharma. A truly real event or the objective truth . It also means the order of law of the universe, immanent, eternal, uncreated. For our purposes, we can just call it ultimate essence. Now, in the early stages of Buddhist philosophy, in the Abhidharma, for instance, there were so many ultimate essences postulated. Then, when the analysis was carried out in deeper and deeper measure, all those ultimate essences were discovered to be not ultimate, not separate. They all dissolved into emptiness. Now, very difficult word, the shunya, the shunyata, the emptiness. It doesn't mean absolute nothingness at all. All these dharmas, which were thought of as ultimate essences and given particular intellectual shapes, so to say, in the context of transcendence, which means of infinity, eternity, immortality, have no separate existence whatsoever, have no characteristics, have no substantiality in the sense in which we understand the word substance. When I use the phrase primordial creative energy, I trust that it is taken to mean nothing which you can cotton on to. You can't. It is the perpetual mystery, ungraspable. This is the important point. And unrelinquishable by you or by me. It deals unto us. I can't deal unto it at all, in any shape or form. When one realizes this, this whole poison of egoism, vanity, selfness completely dissolves, completely vanishes, then this, the person whom you see and hear and meet and so forth, is nothing. Is no thing. This person actually then, if you had the divine eye to see, is the embodiment of transcendence itself. So you see, these ultimate essences in the context of transcendence itself all disappear. Now a wisdom being sees this. Therefore he grasps at nothing. Nothing whatsoever. And yet he lives his life in such a manner that it is like our daily life. He eats, he drinks, he sleeps, he works, he earns his living, and so forth. But that power of transcendence completely flows through his difficult. I'm using wrong language. I was going to say completely flows through his consciousness. That person is now truly conscious, because what is his psychical self-awareness, which is actually his, has completely dissolved. Therefore the universal consciousness flows through him. Now this is only part of the story. I have just touched upon the fringe of it today, like I tried to do last time we met. Just the fringe of it. There are other aspects to it too. Because this sounds as if, oh, it were all a case of something very impersonal and super intellectualized or abstracted altogether from real life. Those other aspects are aspects such as particularly what we call love, but are more or less quite devoid of it. we just are like fish floundering, struggling for life after we've been caught in a net. And we call it love, all that floundering. This power of compassion, of friendliness, of complete sympathy, of utter impartiality, is something we don't know. But it plays its part. And the heart of man can release itself in that, in scores of little things in everyday life. Here in early Indian religious thought, you will find this. The Buddha says, be thou unequaled in loving kindness. In the ordinary sense, in everyday life. In your family, in your community. When you go on strike against your employer, be unequaled in loving kindness. Then let's see what happens. So also do thou suffuse friend and foe with loving kindness. As a mother, even with her life, protects her child, her one and only son, so let one cultivate a loving heart without measure towards all living creatures. Without measure. Because whatever grounds there be for good works undertaken with a view to rebirth, you know, their belief was that if you did, if you were a good chap now, then in your next life, you would be in a better position, until finally one day you were a prime minister or a king, or perhaps a trade union leader. All of them are not worth 1/16th part of that love which is the heart's release. Love alone, which is the heart's release, shines and burns and flashes forth in surpassing them. Now, I think that just two paragraphs to link up these two aspects, the wisdom aspect and the love aspect. Thought and wisdom lead to the impersonal, to the void, to processes, to the becoming stream, to vision. Love leads to persons, to beings, to selves, to individuals, because they are empirical facts within the limited context. love leads to the understanding which is intelligent compassion, to clear-seeing sympathy, or loving clear-sightedness. Thought and love creatively integrate in selfless action by the actor, who is wholly moral and free from all delusion. Through right regarding, one achieves impersonal altruism. No self, as seen by intellect, revealed by spiritual insight and accepted out of wisdom, when adopted as a standard for dealing with myself, makes me selfless and just and fair to others. And person, distinct and individual, as obvious to sense perception, revealed by spiritual insight and accepted out of love, when adopted as a standard for dealing with others, makes me unselfish, considerate, and sympathetic to them. Right doing towards them through personal love is the result.